Welcome, everyone, to the Appia Human Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Carroll, and today I'm extremely excited to have on a guest who knows exactly what it takes to perform at the very highest levels, both mentally and physically. Dr. Ryan Caserta has spent the past 15 years as the lead for cognitive enhancement and research with the United States Special Operations Command, or US SOCOM, where he's worked directly with our nation's special forces to push the limits of human performance. Beyond the military, Doc is at the forefront of cognitive and perceptual training, helping professional and amateur athletes from around the world sharpen their minds, improve their focus, and translate training into real results. His work has led to countless wins and accolades for those he's coached, and today he's here to share how the science of deliberate practice can unlock expertise in anyone, from our nation's servicemen and women and world-class athletes to everyday people chasing their best. So, Doc, great to have you on the show here. Welcome to the pod. How are you today?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited about today's topic. So, yeah, I'm in a great mood.
That's awesome, Doc. No, it's great to have you here. And I do want to set the table for everyone listening prior to us diving in. So before I founded Appia, I competed at a high level of amateur golf, went on to play Division I college golf, and then had a professional career that spanned for the better part of a decade. I was very fortunate to chase my dream, traveled all over the world from South America to Europe to Africa and into Asia, playing the game that I loved. And one of the common denominators along that journey when I had some success was Doc's mentorship. And when I look back, as I often do at my career, you can imagine there are a lot of hurdles and obstacles in the way of trying to climb what is seemingly Mount Everest to get to the top of a sport. And it was just incredibly beneficial and incredibly important to have someone like Doc in my corner, helping me, mentoring me, and we just did so many cool things together out there. So I'm just excited to have him on here to share his knowledge with all of you listening. I hope, Doc, that you remember more of the good shots than the bad as we dive into this first topic of deliberate practice. So I know that you often ask your students, what's the greatest predictor of expertise? And I know most people don't guess it. So we'll start right here. So what's deliberate practice and what does it really mean?
Yeah, no, I only remember all the good shots and all the wins. And it's one of those things where now over the last almost three decades studying expertise, this area is really near and dear to my heart. Because like you, I had dreams of being a professional athlete and performing at that high level, competed at a very high level in multiple sports. And so I was always intrigued in the differences in expertise. And as I started to get into it and study it, you know, deliberate practice really stood out from the research as the biggest predictor of becoming an expert. And I think one of the reasons why people kind of get that wrong or they don't guess it is because oftentimes they think that athletic expertise or greatness comes down to genetics. Mm-hmm. You know, so many times you'll hear people talk about, wow, that's just such a natural talent, or it must be God-gifted abilities to do that. And I can tell you from many of my professional athletes that I've worked with, including yourself over the years in multiple sports, I can tell you it very much frustrates them when people just tag those big wins as just being naturally gifted, because it kind of dismisses all the hard work they put in. I know the GOAT himself, Michael Jordan, often would comment on how frustrated he was because no one worked harder than Jordan. And that behind the scenes that no one ever sees is really what's taking those players to the highest level and just kind of writing it off as just being purely genetic and gifted and a natural talent kind of dismisses all of that.
Oh, it's so true. I think a lot of times you see, a lot of excited parents with the videos of their 5-year-old, swinging a club or a racket or something and just saying, oh, this is going to be my meal ticket. And it's like, well, it could be if he decides to, practice a lot.
Exactly. And I want to give a shout out, really the preeminent expert that I had a lot of time to get to work with over my graduate career, even though he was over at Florida State. We were very close. Dr. Andish Erickson, a cognitive psychologist that really is the expert when it comes to studying expertise and this whole concept of deliberate practice. You know, we used to have arguments and kind of collegial arguments at conferences because he would say there was only two things that were purely genetic and everything else was trainable. So he would say that height, obviously you can't train height. You get that genetically from your parents. If you want to be a gymnast and you're 6'10", it's tough, you know.
Yeah.
It's going to be tough to get there.
Sure. Yeah.
And the reverse is true, right? If you're only 5'9", I think Simone Biles, I've seen her train at the gymnastics facility where my daughter is trained. You know, when you're at that height, there's an advantage to that power and weight ratio, and to see her perform those things in person, just mind blowing. But yeah, if she wants to be an expert in the NBA, it's going to be a hard road. It's tough, right? So height is something that can't be changed and trained in any way. And the other thing that he would talk about, and Dr. Erickson would speak to, visual acuity. Really, we can't train to change how clearly our eyes see. But since a lot of our colleagues were in the College of Health and Human Performance, we would also include things like muscle fiber type. So there's a lot about genetics with muscle fiber types, whether they're the fast twitch and slow twitch. There are partially trainable type 2A muscle fiber types, but you really can't transfer over what you're given genetically.
Right.
So, but it is an interesting topic. It is one that is very controversial. I think a lot of people want to speak to, there's more research in the genetic side that can support that if you just don't have the expert gene, you can't get there.
I would
fight back at that. And I think as people learn more of the importance of deliberate practice, they'll start to see why.
And I think that anybody who has, you know, gotten to any sort of level with you know, specifically with athletics, but it transfers probably into anything, to music, to any sort of high level professional realm there. It's not just about, you know, this gifted talent or this, oh, he just had it from the jump. No, there's quite a bit of practice involved, and specifically to what you're talking about today.
Yeah, and it's interesting you brought up music, because Dr. Erickson's first research study to look into deliberate practice and the theory he developed for the 10,000 hour rule. Many of us have maybe heard that 10,000 hours or 10 years of deliberate practice was back in 1993 with a research study he did with top performers at a German music academy.
Yep.
And so what he found was those elite performers were averaging 10,000 hours by the age of 20. And it's not only just the difference between elite level, but sub-elite for hours, but then how they're dedicating those hours. So it's not just about getting the 10 hours, but how you actually get to the 10 hours that really ends up mattering the most.
100%. And I think the people that do achieve that 10,000 hour, you know, sort of threshold, their hearts are so into what they're doing. I mean, you hear all the time, like, oh, the headlights when it's dark and the person's practicing or whatever. And I mean, I myself did that. I know a lot of others that were in my shoes, you know, did that as well. And it's just so true, because, you just, the love and the passion for whatever they're trying to accomplish is there, and they're going to just practice and work at all possible times, right? It's obsessive almost in a great way.
Oh, absolutely. And before we get into the details of deliberate practice, I want to give you a chance to see if you can guess the second greatest predictor of expertise. That one people don't often get.
You know, it's got to be something with recovery, so sleep.
No way. That's awesome. Yeah, it is.
Hey, I'm an Aura ring wearer here. So, you know, I'm all about it.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think I can count on one hand the number of times in the last, 25, 30 years that anybody has gotten that one. So yeah, you are spot on. Sleep is so critical. I don't think people actually understand how important it is. We don't have time to get into it today. Maybe another podcast. You could probably bring in a sleep expert. That's way beyond my capabilities.
We're already pitching another episode. I love this.
But I'll tell you, you know, what sleep does to impact both those psychological and cognitive developments as you're learning new skills, the musculoskeletal development and kind of recovery that you're speaking about, those are so critical. And so being able to get not only the quantity of those sleep hours, but the quality of those sleep hours, I can tell you over the last 15 years working with our special operation forces military for US SOCOM, you know, unfortunately, our special op guys don't often have the time to get all of those 7 to 8 hours that are recommended through the science. I mean, it has to be an improvement in the quality so that they can still be performing at that elite level and doing all those amazing things that they do for our country.
I mean, it's it makes a lot of sense to me, you know, with all the data that's come out about recovery and all the different modalities, sleep still remains king.
Absolutely. Definitely.
So Doc, I want to kind of jump into a little more deliberate practice. And I know there are really five pillars of deliberate practice. Maybe you can start by explaining what those are or start with one and we can kind of dive in from there.
Sure. Yeah. Let's start with the first one. So the first part of deliberate practice is that it requires effortful activity. So this means that, you know, you can't just be going through the motions, right? Going out and just saying, hey, I got my workout done. Or, you know, if you're working on improving your golf game, or pickleball seems to be really popular, you know, just going out there and just hitting 100 balls at the driving range is really not going to get you there. Right. So when you're putting in that effort and pushing to what's beyond your comfort zone is really what's going to be necessary to keep progressing, right? So one of my favorite quotes is Muhammad Ali that really hits on this first area of deliberate practice, where he said, I hated every minute of training, but I said, don't quit. Suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion. You know, for me, it's kind of like I always bring that back to my forefront of my mind, even as I'm doing workouts. And as I'm getting older now, it's maybe less about winning a championship, but just staying healthy. And
I'll
tell you, I always ask myself, am I putting in that level of being a champion, even with what I'm trying to achieve? Right. So that's a good question that I think people start to ask themselves. And only you can answer that question.
Yeah, of course. And I think that sort of, and this might be a good segue into what this next pillar is, but I think when you hear, you know, what is effortful activity, you know, especially in the sports realm, and there will be a lot of sports parallels today, especially golf, but especially in that sort of realm, we, the people who become very successful, and this will be a, you know, we will all of course draw this back to the everyday life here. But the people who are very successful, they practice what they're not good at a lot of times versus what they are good at. It's easy to go there. I mean, if I'm a good, you know, driver of the golf ball, of course, it's easy for me to take a bucket of balls, go to the range and hit a bunch of drivers. And wow, I've laced them all down the middle of the fairway and I'm happy because it's rewarding. But if I'm not a good wedge player, am I going to sit there and, you know, take that bucket of balls and try to start holing things out from 50 yards, right?
I mean, yeah, you are spot on with that, because a lot of this part of deliberate practice with the effort, it's where it's not fun,
right?
You know, it's getting to yourself where it's uncomfortable. You often almost have to be in that uncomfortable place to start to push beyond, to start to gain levels of expertise. I mean, it's kind of in those moments, and I actually even work to those moments when I'm doing workouts in my garage gym. Whether I'm going for a run, I love getting to that moment where I know I'm pushing to what's uncomfortable. It's no longer fun. It's no longer an enjoyable workout. And I know it's in those moments that no one else knows it's happening besides myself. But I know it's in those moments where I'm making the biggest change to my life. So yeah, when you're, like I said, whether you're in the gym, working out, trying to get those last few reps where, you know, people always say you got to train to failure. Like, I'm trying to train to that point where how many great reps can I get with perfect form to failure, right? I'm not trying to get to ultimate failure where the form then goes away and I could injure myself. And so, but it's just a very, very kind of focused kind of effort. And that kind of brings us to our second one, because it's really kind of not only that amount of effort, but number two, are you targeting a very specific ability? So like to the point I just brought up, when I'm trying to work those last few reps, is my mind really connected and focused on the muscle I'm trying to train, the form that I'm trying to keep, and trying to keep pushing to the last reps I can get underneath those conditions? And that does require not only a whole lot of focused attention to do it, but it requires a focused attention to target an ability, right? I'm targeting the form. I'm targeting things like my breathing and what I'm doing in that way. When I'm on long runs, you know, I really am trying to hit specific goals to target, you know, where am I from, like, you know, my endurance level and how many miles am I kind of getting underneath that kind of feeling of pace, where the first few miles or middle or end of my run or the pacing is at. So when you're not targeting any of it in a specific way, it can get really tough to get better because you're just kind of, again, in that place where you're going through the motions instead of trying to hit very clear and specific goals that you've set for yourself.
So it's funny, Doc, and I want to kind of to bring this back to the listeners here about how there's certainly a lot of joy in, you know, doing what you're good at, right? And but when we tap into this, you know, hey, I'm gonna target something I'm not good at, right? I'm gonna go into something that is maybe not my forte. And you sort of dig it out and you experience the success from something that you're maybe not the best at. Maybe you can talk to the point of how that satisfaction totally outweighs the satisfaction from the accomplishment of doing something you're already good at, right? I mean, and it kind of goes into a little bit of growth mindset. We can go there now and if you'd like, but it's certainly, I think it's very important to kind of mention that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Dr. Carol Dweck's work in growth mindset has been amazing, not only beneficial from an educational perspective. I know it's something that my wife and I are constantly speaking to our children about to get them in that place from an educational perspective. But I think growth mindset is very much something that can be applied to any of the athletes out there or even just your health and wellness journey to keep wanting to learn. I think we learn as much from our mistakes and failures, if not more, on that side of the house than we do from our wins and our successes. I think one of the great examples recently has been both kind of Dustin Johnson on the PGA Tour, not one of my clients, by the way, just to clarify, and also even Rory McIlroy, right? So, you know, Dustin Johnson just hits the ball a mile, right? As you know, he just, he's so long off the tee. I'm sure a lot of us would like to be able to hit it as far as he does. But really the change in his career kind of happened when he started to really put a ton of focus in on improving his wedges, his short game, because where he's driving the ball on par fours or how he's setting up on par fives often is putting that, you know, 100 yards and in a big part of his games. He had a lot of shots from there. So, you know, when he was interviewed, I was interested to hear before he ended up winning, you know, his first major and then earning number one in the world and, you know, kind of getting that Masters and, you know, FedEx Cup championship win. You know, he was talking in the off season when they asked what he was working on. He said pretty much everything 100 yards in. Again, this is a very targeted approach. Rory McIlroy, the same thing. He's been talking recently about how he's been putting more hours in on the course versus just the driving range. Because when you're on the course, you get different lies, you see different shots, it forces you to execute a different shot under different conditions. And you can't recreate that on a flat driving range, right? So, you know, there's putting yourself in those environments and learning how to adjust can allow you to then get to those gains. And that's where overcoming the things you're not good at is so much more rewarding, like you said. So I would argue if you are going at it from a health and wellness perspective, right? If you are really targeting something like hypertrophy or power or strength within your weight training. Mm-hmm. Well, what part of the journey needs to be improved, right? Yeah, like you said, maybe my upper body and my pull side of that strength training, especially with biceps, it's great. But maybe I need more push side or leg work. And that's where targeting those can, again, give you a lot more reward to be able to make additional gains. I think there's a big part of that. Those two aspects of effort and targeting, that's ability, that's so vital to continue to make gains long term.
100%. And I think maybe one of the examples that I was given actually recently, as I still do play some golf and somewhat competitive amateur golf. I was always, when I was playing, you know, it's very easy to tell somebody, oh, you know, here's the moment and you got to be above it. And all this stuff about it, kind of like, you know, get ready and go out there and do it. And I was given some advice actually recently about getting lost in the game. And I know you're going to agree with this one. It's very growth mindset, you know, oriented to say, hey, go out there and get lost in it and get lost in the journey and get lost in yourself and in what you're doing. And that's going to be what ultimately brings that talent out of you, not this grit and bear, like, you know, kind of mentality that so many people take, not just with golf, obviously that's the example here, but with everything in life. And I maybe you can speak to how folks can do some things to get lost in whatever it is they're doing. I mean, I don't know if something comes to your head that might help, agree.
I agree 100%. And it's something that Dr. Dweck talks about within her growth mindset. You know, really, it's getting away from the results side of it and 100%. Just purely doing it for the result. And oftentimes, this is where the result can be so far away that you can't touch it or feel it or see it. If you're wanting to lose weight, if you're wanting to get stronger, trust me, I'm trying to lean up and put on mass and some muscle. Now that I'm over the hill, it's harder to put on muscle than it was back in the 20s and 30s. I'll be honest with you. Even the 40s, it was easier then. But I'll tell you, it's where I'm less focused on that ultimate result and goal. I know what it is. I've written it down. My sights are on it. But when I'm in the moment, what you're describing and getting lost is what really the science is talking about. You're so focused in the process and the enjoyment of that learning journey. And like I even talk with both of my kids, that learning journey is not always great. It's hard, right? Mm-hmm. You know, now my son's in high school. He's starting geometry. Geometry's different than you think
that.
He had.
I still can't believe that, by the way.
I know.
That makes me feel ancient.
You know my kids when they were really young and then when they were born. Yeah,
when they were born.
We've known each other a long time.
That's insane to me.
So, but it's like I keep telling them, you know, it's that learning process where you're enjoying where those mistakes are happening because it's teaching you how to acquire the knowledge in a way where you'll really be able to master it because you're going to have to learn why you got it wrong and how you need to adjust to move forward. And so I can give you a great example for myself. I have to brag a little bit, probably the best performance dietitians, if not the best performance dietitians I get the pleasure of working with at the U.S. Special Operations Command, and their work they do with our military is spectacular.
I'm sure.
And with some of the work that I've done with them from the nutrition side really started to show me how poorly I was targeting specific areas of my nutrition, right? So starting to use some of the apps to get my macros corrected, I started to realize how far off my macros really needed to be if I wanted to lean out and put on some size. And of course, they warned me. They said, okay, if you're wanting to up your cardio and have a lot more of that, you are not eating the way that's correct for that. Like you have to change that. So they warned me, if you're going to go change your workout and you're going to be putting in more hours and you need more endurance, you're going to need to come back to us and we're going to need to adjust this. So I think it's a great personal experience that I can share with people to get them to understand this is to the level of detail that deliberate practice, I think, is just so dismissed, right? It's just genetics. That's why everybody's great. No. I mean, even for someone like me at my age, I did not have my macros correct. And in changing those, now it's helping me to get to my specific goals. But if those goals change in any way, all of these areas need to be revisited to be restructured to get targeted correctly.
Yeah, there's a constant sort of, you know, there's a constant, you know, looking at it, right?
Yeah, an evolution, I would say.
And that maybe brings us into feedback loop, which I know is a really the next pillar here in deliberate practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the feedback loop is the third area of deliberate practice. And a feedback loop can come in the form of many different things. So a lot of what we talked about, like I talked to you about the performance dietitian, and like what the work I was doing for you on the perceptual cognitive skill side, our coaches that we go to are great feedback loops. And I will tell you, the best coaches in the world are really good at knowing what you need right now, but prepping you for taking you to the next level when you're ready for it. They almost are anticipating where to move you to keep your progression where you don't have as many plateaus and you don't start to have as many dips in performance. Because this is where frustration can set in. It can be hard to keep doing the other things of deliberate practice, putting in that effort, you know, staying focused to target what you're trying to work on. Those levels of frustration can really kind of derail us. So,
Doc, I got to stop you because feather in your hat here. When we first started working together, it's right out of the same vein of what you're just saying. When we first started working together, I can remember the first time we worked. Working on putting, working on some stuff there, again, perceptual type stuff. I left that, well, feeling like $1 million. I also was home from traveling and played a mini tour event like 2 days later, which I won. And I could also see the long game. I was like, whoa, if this keeps up, you know, this is going to be pretty cool. And I think it's to your point about great coaches, which you are, you can see the short term, the long term, you know, you can even sometimes predict where, hey, there might be a little valley here that we've got to work through.
Absolutely. And I do remember that win. That's why I told you, I don't forget those. Over all these years, my goal has always been to make sure no matter what athlete I work with, that they're getting to those goals they've set. It doesn't have to be a Masters champion to have been successful, in my opinion. Sure. But those little wins along the way add up. So going beyond the coaching side, because that's the obvious feedback loop. But one of the things I would tell people is they can start to use their phone with video. They can use mirrors. If you're trying to check your form, you know, there are times where, you know, if I'm lifting in the gym, that's one thing I've had to add to my home gym after COVID, when they closed all the gyms, I said, well, you're not going to keep me from my workouts. That's my mental sanity. And I'm trying to get to some goals. So putting some mirrors up in my gym so that when I'm performing those lifts, I'm keeping the form correctly. That's a great feedback loop. Now, do I go back and check in with my coach to make sure what I'm doing is correct? Absolutely. But you could benefit from videoing yourself, or putting up a mirror can be a great feedback loop. And I would say in terms of feedback loops now, we're kind of in an era of life that is just, I mean, the best we could ever ask for, because there's so many apps out there. Like you mentioned, the Oura Ring, if you're using Garmin, I mean, there's a ton of companies and, you know, everybody kind of knows and is getting a lot of information from all of them to sign up. But, you know, finding the right apps and devices to give you that feedback, because to be quite honest, if you're on a nutrition journey and you're not maybe getting feedback from body comp measures and biofeedback measures, it's going to be tough to keep getting those gains. It's going to be tough to make the gains in the weight room if you're not tracking those. So the feedback loop can come into effect to know, hey, I woke up and my Oura Ring kind of gave me some feedback on where I was last night. And having that kind of level of information can help you to train smarter the next day. I actually think that if I were to cite one team it has to be, you know, Steph Curry and, you know, Golden State Warriors. Mm-hmm. They really were probably one of the first teams, especially in the NBA, that started to really leverage a lot of the feedback loops from these different advanced technologies and human performance to make sure that how they're training over the season is keeping them healthy. Because the longer they're staying healthy and the longer you have your best players playing games, the more wins you can have and the more championships you can win, right? So you can do that even at home on your own level, right? That doesn't have to be on a professional sports team. But I would definitely recommend, and I think you'd probably agree with me on this, a lot of these devices give a ton of information. And sometimes it can be overwhelming. And you don't have a PhD in all of them. I don't have a PhD in everything. Having those experts in exercise physiology and nutrition, the strength training side, you know, there's a lot of sports medicine. I've had a whole lot of injuries in my lifetime. Being able to talk to those physical therapists. You know, really those experts are the ones you need to be able to use with the data to keep getting better, because we're not all going to have the answers to every part of that piece of the puzzle.
Of course. And that's kind of, I mentioned that actually on our first episode about how we live in this day and age where there's so much information and you can get inundated with that information. So you've got to be able to interpret the data and apply it, really, because that's the ultimate goal of collecting it. It's not to just, you know, I get my Oura Ring stats when I wake up and I you know, I don't have a chart on my wall that says, oh, my HRV was great last night. You know, that's not the point, right? The point is to better improve, you know, these metrics and ultimately how we're feeling and how we're performing and how we're, you know, behaving in everyday life. So Doc, kind of as we transition from feedback loop to the next pillar, which is that experience doesn't necessarily mean everything, right?
Right. Yeah. It doesn't come down to just the experience.
Right.
You need experience. You need to get out there and have those moments. But if you're just kind of going out there just to play a ton of rounds of golf, or you're just going in to just do your workout in the gym and get out of there, you know, just putting those experiences together mindlessly won't help you, right? There's a lot to be learned within those experiences. And I think when people really start to get into it and finding the right balance between what work they're doing and what they're targeting and bringing all of these areas together, that experience just has a wealth of information to benefit from. And they're going to start to see a lot more gains in that respect. Absolutely.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Any examples that you can kind of touch on with that?
So yeah, specifically, you know, right now for me, I'm starting to add more running back into my life. While I was trying to put size on, my most recent recommendations from my doctor this year was you got to get more cardio in your life, because ultimately, while the research does support with aging, both benefits from weight training and from cardio work, if there's ever the slightest edge in the research, the science says long-term cardiovascular work is going to help you for longevity, maybe slightly more than the strength training. And, you know, again, I think the strength training is important to keep muscle on the body, helps your metabolism to kind of keep burning. And as you get older, if you have any issues with bumps and bruises, if you do have a fall, the muscle's there to kind of protect your body from having any broken bones and things like that.
Yeah,
so,
makes total sense.
I've gotten back into more cardio. And so a lot of the times those long runs, that's not been my area of expertise. All the sports I played in, when I was younger, I trained and competed at an elite level in tennis. And I'll tell you, you know, tennis is a lot of short, fast, high bursts of speed, changing direction. I can't, you know, right now the game has moved to a place with Sinner and Alcaraz that I just can't even fathom.
You know, you want to talk about real quick at a great example of everything with deliberate practice. You know, Alcaraz spent 2 weeks training specifically to play Sinner. I mean, that to me is amazing. Number one, speaks to how great he is, but also to take 2 weeks and just say, I'm going to only train to beat this one guy.
Absolutely. On the U.S. Open broadcast for the women's final, I saw that Sabalenka had brought in, I think, Max Mirny.
Yeah, she's got Max Mirny, yeah.
Yeah, he was just an absolute beast on tour, doubles, superstar, very good in singles as well. But his expertise serving and volleying and how to control the net, I mean, that's the level of detail. Again, trying to get that expertise and experience detailed down to improving that net part of her game. Again, all trying to target that with deliberate practice. So,
you know, when you look at the best, right, in tennis, you can say it was the big three. Now it's Alcaraz and Sinner. You know, golf, it's obviously Tiger, Scottie Scheffler, McIlroy, all these people. When you look at the best, it's always so poised, right? And when you look at the people trying to sort of get to the top, right? It's always like the boat's taking in water, and they're there with a bucket, and they're trying to dump water out of the ship, right? And I think it's very interesting as we study what deliberate practice is, as we look at those that are just the absolute best, and how poised they are. Right. How they never crack. And then to beat them, it's like, oh my gosh, it takes force majeure to beat them. Like everything has to go wrong for them and right for the other guy or whatever. Right. Do you have any kind of insight as to why that's the case? Maybe why they seem so poised? Is it just because they've done it, you know, they've just mastered this deliberate practice, you think, so well? You think that plays into it?
Well, that poise and that grit, that mental toughness, that is also needs right. to be trained as a part of deliberate practice, right? So it was really great to kind of see that evolution in many of those athletes where your first time in a final, it is very tough to win your first time in a final. But as you continue to move on, what you learn from it and kind of developing that poise again is not some naturally gifted thing. So what I would say in terms of people starting to practice some of this stuff, especially from an experience, trying to fine tune that experience side, you know, for me, I had been doing a really high intensity weight training workout that was never under an hour. It was at least an hour to an hour and a half, and some even took longer for the amount of reps and sets that I was doing. But maintaining that long term was just not something I was going to be able to do year after year after year. So I did that for a very specific number of months and then had to readjust. Like I said, long distance running is not my area of expertise, but I've now mixed the intensities on my cardio and kind of providing a little bit more of a kind of periodized program for running, which is getting me excited because there are some days that I go fast and it's short, but then other days I kind of know to settle in because it's going to be a long run and I start to enjoy that, right? If I would say anything about our special operations community and what makes them great is they've learned to love it when it's the worst, right? Like enjoy the suck.
get lost in it.
Exactly. I mean, you brought that lost up in earlier. It. That's the exact same concept. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So, Doc, let's go to the last pillar here of deliberate practices, which is this X factor, this motivation to learn. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So this last one, I call it the X factor because the motivation to learn really is something that comes from you, right? I mean, we as coaches can provide you motivation. There are things that you can get from support from your family and friends, your spouse, your loved ones to keep giving you that motivation to keep moving forward. But ultimately, it's that intrinsic motivation that will be the difference maker. And that is different from person to person. You know, you really have to start, if I would give advice to people, is you really need to start to dig in and start to understand your why. You know, there's a lot of research out there and conversations around the topic of why. I think it's Simon Sinek is a really big, I apologize if I got his name wrong, but a big proponent of finding your why. And like we talked about with growth mindset, you know, there needs to be something that you have that pushes you when it gets tough. Because think about this, that motivation to get up when it's super early, you know, people talk about how hard it is to get up when it's early. Absolutely. You have to fight the alarm clock. You have to fight the comfort of your bed, the warmth of being in your bed and underneath those sheets and not really wanting to get up early and go work out. I would also argue you could fight even more things to get your workout in at night. You know, oftentimes I don't get time to do it in the morning because I have to be up early to get to base. And so I'm working out often in the evening, having to overcome what work I kind of need to get done from a work perspective, family work and commitments to my family, trying to fit in dinner and cooking and helping kids with homework. And then, you know, the weather. I mean, to be able to have the motivation to still push those aside and still get the workout in, that's time for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's always going to be something that you have to overcome. But when you've actually made the conscious choice to say, regardless of those things, I am choosing to move forward. I'm choosing to take on what I've put forth and wanted to do. It only takes that one choice for the day. It makes it easier for the next day for that choice to be made. And every day you keep making the choice, the way I look at it as, I've had a run now of like the last 6 years where I've not ever chosen to just take that break or not do it. Now I have a streak going. I can't break the streak, right? I mean, you got to keep the streak alive.
Not to put a plug here for Appia, but you have consistency.
I listened to your first podcast. I very much enjoyed it.
I was going to say,
I want to bring it back. I would tell listeners, if you haven't gone back to that first podcast to listen to the consistency talk, that one really speaks to what I'm talking about here. I mean, having that consistency over time, it takes just that one day, but consistency as it builds is such a powerful impact to your life. So yeah, I really love the first podcast.
Thank
Absolutely. Go back and listen to that one if you didn't listen to that one.
No, thanks. And it's just so true to everything, to your points that you're talking about here, that how this consistency, you know, makes things habits, and habits make you every day now better, right? I mean, it's so simple. And I think we sometimes make it so complex, but it's, you just start small and you start to form those habits and form that consistency. All of a sudden the snowball rolls and, you know, here we are. For your example, you're 6 years or whatever you said, and you're consistent in what you're doing, and you feel great, and you know you're just a better, more switched on individual, right? I mean, isn't that
And that's why I was so excited to have this talk with you today, because anyone I talk to, my advice is to them that if you can find your why, if you can have that growth mindset, if you can fiercely go after what's hard, right? Mm. That's where you find greatness, right? It's on the other side of the hard work, the doubt, the pain, the failure. And that's where you have to have that intrinsic motivation to find it. But there's a lot of reward in that when you finally get there.
100%. And I think that, you know, we've talked today a lot about the, you know, the elite athlete, right? Or elite athletes. But there are so many parallels between what they might do and what the everyday person has to do. I mean, you just gave in your own example of, hey, I got to get my workout in, but there's kids and there's homework and there's dinner and there's work and there's blah, 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 all these different things, right? And that's the same thing that, you know, a hurdle that an athlete might encounter. Now it's a little more glamorous. It's, oh, I've got, you know, media coverage and I have to get my massage and I have to get all my other, you know, cool things, right? Done to me before I can do what I've got to do. But it's the same sort of hurdle and the same sort of mental fortitude it takes to have the accomplishment at the end of the day. Am I correct?
Yeah, I was going to say, championships at the elite level are way in my rearview mirror. And so health and wellness and longevity, I'm very interested in a lot of the work that's being done even through Harvard with longevity, because right now, the more I can be active and a part of my family's life, my children's lives, you know, that's what kind of motivates me. That's my why to wake up and still do that workout, or to get in there when it's, you know, 8:30 at night. That garage is right there. There's no excuse. I don't have to drive anywhere. All I got to do is walk out to the garage.
You got to just walk a few feet.
Yeah.
So, you just have to pass the TV and not get sucked into whatever show you're watching.
Yeah, I think I could, if I do it in the morning, just the alarm clock in the bed might be easier than all the other hurdles at night. But yeah,
100%.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, like we said, this is beyond just the elite athlete. I really think when it comes to a health and wellness perspective for, you know, people for their life and longevity, these deliberate practice things are often not talked about. They're overlooked. Sometimes people just dismiss it as, well, that person has that amazing body and they look great because they just naturally have that. Now, yes, like I said earlier in the podcast, there are certain parts about my genetics that maybe my muscle structure and my size, and because of my height and my genetics, I'm never going to look like Dwayne Rock Johnson, right? I'm not going to look like him. I'm never going to be able to get to that, right? Just because I won't have the frame or the muscle fiber type to get there, right? But sure. I've kind of set my own goals and put things in perspective. And then, like I said, gotten back to enjoying the journey and enjoying what was hard to keep learning from it. And then before you blink, you know, this is one of the things you always hear. The days are long. But the years go by fast.
That's so true.
And as I blink, all of a sudden it's been 6 years and I look in the mirror and I'm like, wow, yeah, my body's getting a lot closer to what I had envisioned. But it's by staying focused with these deliberate practice principles to really focus in on what I'm learning each day as I go forward and evolving and adjusting, like we've talked about on today's podcast.
Gotta get lost in it, Doc. Yeah. So effort, feedback, quality over hours, motivation to really keep going. That's what separates us from, you know, the best from the rest, right?
Absolutely.
So Doc, thanks so much for sharing all this. This was so valuable. Where can people connect with you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, they can find me at my website. It's ryancaserta.com. They can go there and be able to find me. And then, yeah, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all the different sites. But that's probably the easiest way for them to find me if they have any questions.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Doc, again for joining us today and breaking down the science and the grind behind deliberate practice. There are so many takeaways from today, everything from the quality of the hours of your practice to the feedback that you seek and the motivation that keeps you moving forward. Whether you're chasing mastery in sports, business, or just trying to be better in your everyday life, deliberate practice is the pathway. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure to share it with a friend who's working on their own journey, and don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This is the Appia Human Performance Podcast. I'm Matt Carroll, reminding you that greatness lives on the other side of hard work. We'll see you next time.